It is well accepted that Jaws is an all-time great film, but its progeny don't rank nearly as high. Two True Freaks is proud to present Is It Jaws, where Paul Spitero and Sean Whalen are joined by an all-star list of guest hosts to review old and new films and place them on the Jaws scale, where they're ranked from Jaws to Jaws 4. Of course, for the purposes of the show, that scale does take some liberties with their actual ratings. Sure, movies that are given the ranking of Jaws are considered classic films with few flaws, if any. A ranking of Jaws 2 indicates that the film is very good and worthy of repeated viewings. A Jaws 3 ranking indicates the film was okay, but that's all. A Jaws 4 means it's ranked as a bad movie. Oh, and if you ever saw Back to the Future Part 2, you know that there's a Jaws 19. That ranking indicates that the movie is so incredibly bad that it's actually fun to watch as a result. So please join Paul and Sean as they ask the ever-important question, is it Jaws?
With a turn of a knife and a twist in the plot, Death Trap is everything it's not.
Sydney, people are always interested in psychics who can point at someone and say, that man murdered that man.
Are you trying to say that you don't think that you can trust me?
Sydney? My heart won't take it.
Death Trap. Death Trap.
Death Trap!
To show you any more would be a crime. So join Michael Caine, Christopher Reeve, and Diane Cannon in Ira Levin's Death Trap.
In for the kill, right?
No, definitely not. Blood in the carpet.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to Is It Yours? I'm Paul Spitero, and I am here with some of my favorite people. My good buddy, Mr. Sean Whalen.
It is great to be here, buddy.
It's great to have you here. And my very good friends, Ruth and Darren Sutherland. How are you guys doing?
Hi. Happy to be here.
Always great to talk with both of you.
And honestly, always great to talk to both of you. So we are covering today Death Trap, the 1982 Michael Caine, Christopher Reeve movie. And I believe, Darren, this was your suggestion, if I remember correctly.
I think it was, yes.
So this is a movie based on a play. I first saw this on VHS tape. I liked it a lot. I thought it was very cool. Every time I've seen it, I somehow see in my mind, I see it as a stage play. It's filmed in a way where it feels like a stage play. So, you know, Sidney Lumet, who directed this, who's got a great filmography of movies that you could check out. But I assume he wanted to stay true to the play feel, you know, because he could have done some things to make it feel more cinematic instead. But I think it succeeds based on that feeling. I like that feeling about it. There's something about it that feels a little bit raw because it feels like a play. And I had not seen this in quite a while, but then I rewatched it with my wife for the sake of recording with you guys today. And that same feeling came back, and I enjoyed it again very much. I loved the plot twists and how everything goes with it. And even knowing the plot twists, it really did not take away from my enjoyment of rewatching it. So that said, let's get into all of your initial experiences with watching this. Sean, what do you say?
So I originally saw this in the 80s at some point. It had to have been, you know, shortly after the release. It was Showtime or HBO. Don't remember which. It was, you know, the early days of cable, you know, when cable was like destination television at the time. And I remember liking it. The nice part about I haven't seen this since then. So I saw it like twice back then because I enjoyed it. And then it'd been years since I'd seen it. So when it was suggested for this, I literally watched this last night. So it was very fresh. I remembered Michael Caine was in it. I remember Christopher Reeve was in it. I remembered like the basics of the plot. But so much of how this plays out, and we'll talk about it throughout it, the twists and turns and things, I didn't remember how everything wound up going the way that it did. So this was a very fresh rewatch for me because of the fact that there was so much of it that I didn't remember. So we'll talk.
Nice. That makes it enjoyable. You still get some of the surprises along the way.
It's very similar for us. It sounds like we all sort of saw it around the same point in time. Ruth and I had started dating in 1981. So this was a date night movie for us in 1982 sometime. So we saw it back then and have always liked it. And what prompted me to suggest it was, I know you both know, we go to the Carolina Theater a lot that has retro weekends and lots of film festivals. And they played it at the Carolina Theater a year or two ago. And it was just wonderful to see it with a huge audience. And that the screenings there are always made up of, you know, 50% people our age and 50% Duke University college students. So there's always a large group of people from Duke University who've never seen the movies being shown. And it was so much fun to see it with an audience because there were so many of those 20-somethings in the theater who had never seen it before. And we could hear them gasp at, you know, the twists and turns and some of the surprises that were controversial 40 years ago and just all the laughter out loud. And it got a big round of applause at the end. So when we saw it with that group of people, we were just like, oh, this is one we should suggest to talk about next if you two were interested. So I'm glad you were.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And I want to interrupt our discussion just to say that if you're listening and you haven't seen this movie, I believe that you would be better off if you pause us right now and watch the movie. And I don't see why, honestly, anybody would avoid doing that. I mean, it's Michael Caine, Christopher Reeve, Diane Cannon, it's Sidney Lumet. It's, you know, it's certainly extremely watchable. And the twists that come, and I'm sure we're going to spoil them to some extent, you know, it's better if you don't know what's coming. So I definitely recommend that you pause us, watch it, and then come back and listen to the rest of this. So
great recommendation.
We'll wait for you right here. Don't worry about it. So I guess I'm going to start with what I mentioned earlier about the direction. It really felt to me like Lumet tried to film this so that it felt like you were watching a stage play. Did you guys get that feeling as well, or was that just me?
Oh, I'm there with you. So I did feel that play aspect of it, which I enjoyed very much. You know, just the, you know, that, you know, live, you know, vibrance connected with the audience type of feeling with their performances was just stunning.
Yeah, limited sets. So you just feel a big open set. That house they used is just a wonderful open set feeling. And yes, you really do feel like you're watching a play. I think that's a great observation.
I also thought limited cast. I think there's more, you know, what you're used to with a play. You know, there's usually, you know, a more compressed cast because of the fact that you're doing that piece. Everything about how this was put together felt like that. I didn't remember that from the 80s. I don't think it was on my radar back then. But this time around, I definitely noticed that piece.
It's such a good point, Sean, because even there's one scene, and I won't spoil it for right now. There's one scene that's filmed outside at a event, and it's filmed basically across the river from a distance. So the one scene that has, you know, more than four people in it is filmed from so far away you can't make out anyone's face even. So yeah, good point.
Yeah, and I mean, it's primarily done in the you know, the house of Michael Caine's character, who's Sidney Brule, who's a playwright. It opens up with him having a Broadway flop. He receives a script sent from Cliff Anderson, who's played by Christopher Reeve, and hijinks ensue. Again, I don't want to give away too much. Diane Cannon plays Michael Caine's wife. She is, to say the least, extremely high strung. And they are primarily the characters in this movie. I mean, you have the next door neighbor who is a psychic, and you have Brule's attorney. And then I believe there's, you know, maybe one or two other minor little thing people that come across at some point or another, but that's really it. And the story is very self-contained. I've often said, and I'm curious to see what you guys think, that Michael Caine has been in some great movies, some mediocre movies, and some bad movies. But Michael Caine, I don't believe I've ever seen give a bad performance. I don't think I've ever seen a movie where he mailed it in. And maybe he did, but it doesn't come across as him doing that. You know, when he talks about doing Jaws the Return, he talks about it as if he mailed it in. But his performance is still charming to me, even though the movie is pretty ridiculous. So I think he lifts the material that he's given in virtually every movie he's in.
Yeah, I agree completely about that. He always gives a top-notch performance, and this is one. This is one of my favorite movies of his. But you're right. There's a range of movie quality, but his performance is always great.
He has a strong emotional range in this too, which is really great. Because not only is he having genuine emotion, but then we have to see him act out emotions, and he has to play it in a way where we feel like he is putting on a show, which I think is just a different layer to what he was doing in this. I just thought that part was really brilliant, because I think that's hard to do. It's hard when you're showing, you know, like deep, you know, stress and frustration and things like that. Then you have to sell it that I'm trying to trick somebody. And yet you're showing that same emotion in a different way. I thought that was something that he did. I thought he was just outstanding in this, just with how many different things that he was able to show on screen this time around. It was cool.
Yeah, you know what? I didn't even think of it from that perspective, and I think you're 100% right, because there's points in there where he's showing his honest feelings to an extent. Mm-hmm. But I even believe when he's doing it, he's always being, you know, his character is always being guarded on what he's willing to show to the other characters in the movie. But then there's also a point where he's trying to, you know, to fool somebody into thinking that he feels a certain way when he doesn't. Or there's more than one scene, honestly, that he does that in. So he has to kind of like drop it down slightly and make it look like, you know, that if you're watching it carefully, you could see he's faking a little bit, but not really. And it's a layered performance. And I think that is really, you know, brought to the front and makes his character in this all the more enjoyable.
And I think it's all those layers bring depth to the film and draw you in even more, because you're paying attention and you're watching all of these subtle details as they change along the way.
Yeah, agreed. And you know, you're watching the movie and you're trying to take in what he's saying, and you're trying to judge, you know, does he really believe this? Does he not? What's he thinking? And you're trying to do that with him. You're trying to do that with Christopher Reeve's character as well. And you know, again, spoilers. So if you're still with us, you know, hopefully you've seen the movie. You know, Diane Cannon's character is not in on the sting, so to speak. And so, you know, you start wondering, you know, what's her role in this? Does she believe what she's saying? Does she believe what they're saying? You know, where is it going with that? And then the same thing with Helga Tendorp, who's the psychic next door. So there's, you know, again, a lot of stuff going on there.
When you're mentioning Helga, it's something I thought kind of interesting. Tendorp backwards is portend.
Oh.
Which is so cool. I mean, that was done.
Yeah.
You know, to foretell the future, which was kind of cool.
Well, that's a great observation. Thank you.
Yeah, Sean. Very good.
That is very interesting. So the next biggest character in the movie is Christopher Reeve playing Clifford Anderson. Now, Christopher Reeve, I think we all have a soft spot in our hearts for Christopher Reeve, not only for what he brought to the screen for us, but also, you know, what he went through in his life. And you know how sad that is, that it ended so early, and that the last, you know, however many years were, you know, in a wheelchair. So, you know, you got to feel, I think, for him. But to pull myself out a little bit, I feel like his performance in this is good, but I don't, like, next to Michael Caine, I think he felt just a slight bit stiff. And now that could be exactly what we were talking about. He's playing a role. Throughout the movie, he's playing a role, honestly. First, he's trying to fool Diane Cannon. Then he's trying to fool Michael Caine. So he's doing, you know, he's playing a part. But his words sounded slightly more wooden to me. Which, again, could be his attempt to show, you know, his character's inability to be as good of an actor as Christopher Reeve is.
Interesting. Very interesting. I know I do remember reading, you know, Christopher Reeve took this part to play something completely different to help, you know, from typecasting. And it's interesting because this is probably my favorite performance of his. Mm. And it's interesting to me because it's like in that first scene that he's in when he, you know, is at the house and he's brought his only copy of the play that he's written, and he's just so excited to be sharing it with his, you know, his mentor and his idol. And then to see how he starts to realize what Michael Caine might really be thinking and might really be planning. And you can just see the nervousness build in him, both, I think, in his eye movements and his facial reactions and even in his nervousness of his movements, and how that scene, you know, develops and turns. And then, of course, like you're talking about, you know, that's just a performance. And then later on, when we sort of see him as the other version of himself, and he is, you know, sort of revealing what he's really thinking and really planning. And, you know, you have Michael Caine call him a sociopath. And he's rattling off, you know, things so quickly, like he's a completely different person. And I can imagine why Christopher Reeve chose this, because he basically plays two completely different characters in this movie, playing one character. And I love his performance. So it's interesting to hear that different take on it.
What was intriguing about him, I didn't get to watch the whole thing again this morning, but what I did do is I went back to a couple of scenes just to see them again. It is interesting to watch, and it was something Paul said before triggered something I noticed this morning. It was interesting to watch the parts of the opening sequence with him again, knowing that he was portraying a fictitious character. It was very interesting to see that play out and know that you mentioned stings earlier. There are multiple stings in this.
Oh,
and
yes.
Up to the point where anybody who showed up on screen, whether they were trustworthy or not, you didn't trust them because you're like, are they in on this? Who is this? I loved that about the film. I didn't trust anybody by about the halfway point of this film. Somebody walks in, I'm like, okay, what's he in on? What's she doing? That part was really, really fun. I didn't expect it to feel like that way because I'd seen it before, but I loved when I was watching it through. I didn't trust a soul that walked through that door. And I think that's a success of this, because it's supposed to be that. It's supposed to make you question people and wonder what's going to happen next, which is captivating, right? You're looking for the signs. And I think the film accomplished that really well.
Just interestingly, I was curious about the play itself, and I looked to see, and that basically was on Broadway from 1978, so it's not all that long before this movie came out. And the part of Sidney Brule was originally played by an actor named John Wood, who I'm not very familiar with, and it said replacements included Stacy Keach, John Cullum, who I'm also not familiar with, Robert Reed, and Farley Granger. The play had 1,793 performances. In every one of them, Myra Brule was played by Marion Seldes, who is apparently a dedicated Broadway actress. And interestingly enough, Clifford Anderson was initially played by Victor Garber.
Oh, interesting.
So just a little extra there.
Yes.
Diane Cannon. Now, I've always thought Diane Cannon was very pretty, and usually she's not playing a character who's all that deep. You know, she's not, I don't think she's usually required to have all that much range. All of a sudden it's coming to me, the part, you know, how she screams in this every once in a while. Was she also the girlfriend/wife in Heaven Can Wait with Warren Beatty? Because I think there was like a similar thing where she would scream like when he came into the room.
That sounds familiar. She might be, but it's been decades since I've seen that.
She was in Heaven Can Wait. I just was looking it up just to kind of back up what you're saying. It does. I don't have the role in front of me. She played Julia Farnsworth in it, but
yes, she plays. I remember she plays Warren Beatty's character's wife. Warren Beatty is, I don't mean to go too so far afield, but he's somebody who is wrongly brought to heaven before his time. So they have to find somebody who's about to die and put his soul into that body. The body that they put the soul into, who then we see as Warren Beatty, was Diane Cannon's husband. When the character was scheduled to die, it was because she and her boyfriend were poisoning him. So, like, he walks in the room and she screams because she expects him to be dead. And same thing. So it's a very similar acting range to this movie, for whatever that's worth.
It's interesting that you mentioned that, yes, because I was surprised that she got a Golden Raspberry Award, I think, for this movie, which I don't think is deserved. She does play her character, as you mentioned, is not really in on what's going on. So her character is more there to be manipulated by the others. And so she doesn't have to be quite as depth or play as much of a range. But I think she has one amazing scene in the movie. And do you want me to tell that, Ruth? I know it's your favorite too. When Michael Caine is on the telephone with Christopher Reeve before we've met him, setting up that initial meeting, and the camera's just following Michael Caine around as he's walking in a circle having that conversation on the telephone. And she knows what he's thinking, and she can't believe it. And every time the camera circles back around and we see her briefly as it passes by, her expression changes so much each time that I think that's a brilliant scene of hers. The rest of her character is very superficial, very sort of straightforward. But that, I think, shows a lot of depth that I'm surprised that people would have commented on otherwise.
There's one area where I thought that she had an interesting little layer to her. It was as everything got revealed, you know, and she all of a sudden starts getting into it.
Yeah.
Like, you know, which I thought that was an interesting choice, because it's clear she loves him to a certain extent because she's ready to throw him out because she's mortified by what happened. But then later finds out that, like, she says, I wanted you to do this. I thought it was these are very flawed characters. and I thought that layer was interesting to add to her. It added a little bit of depth as far as I'm not advocating for people to like be perversely interested in murder. But I just thought for her character it was an interesting arc where she was mortified. Then, you know, she takes him because you got to love somebody to take him into your confidence on that level. You're revealing something that is really wrong with you. And was sharing that moment with him, I think, figuring that that was some camaraderie between the two. And I actually thought that was an interesting scene in the context of this film, which was just unique, I thought.
Absolutely, Sean. I had forgotten about that. I'm so glad you mentioned it because, yeah, it's like she gets an adrenaline rush out of it.
Yeah.
It hits her a little later, and she's then all on board.
I think there's also a little bit more depth of character shown when the purported murder first happens and she starts saying, you know, we'll give a little time and then you'll leave and you could have the house or whatever. Like when she just becomes very, very stoic after having been so jumpy, you know, she's very, now she's thought it out, and this is the way she feels she has to go. And then she has that turn that Sean mentioned, where all of a sudden she starts getting into it. So it shows a lot of, it shows more range than I was originally willing to give credit for until we started discussing it. Now that we're discussing it, I'm thinking, yeah, you know what? Not only did she not deserve a Golden Raspberry, but she gave a pretty solid performance.
Good for us for all seeing that. Yes.
Yeah, and thank you guys for turning me on that.
You mentioned the house, the exterior of the house.
Oh, yes.
It was an 1885 cottage in East Hampton, New York. And I read that in 2017, for $11.9 million, Robert Downey Jr. purchased it. Oh, that's just the exterior. It's got nothing to do with the interior, but the exterior that was used for the exterior scenes, he owns that house. Well, at least he did as of 2017. There's nothing about what who its current owner is. Things change.
Well, it's a great purchase. It's a gorgeous house. It just is so striking with that windmill and the gray wood and the interior design as well. I love the writer's nook with the desk and with all of the weapons, just at arm's reach away. So amazing setup inside and outside for the show.
Just imagine what Iron Man's done with it with all of his money now.
Yeah, I would say he can afford it. I mean, the only other characters of any note at all are the lawyer played by Henry Jones. And Henry Jones is an actor. He's one of those that guys. Where when you see him, you say, oh, yeah, I know I've seen this guy in 100 things before. And he's fine. He plays his part. And then the other thing is Joe Silver, who's another guy who you've seen before and you've heard him before with his voice. And he's got a very small part, and you see him at the very beginning and the very end of the movie. Otherwise, you have some theater critics who appear on TV, and but nobody else of significance. Any thoughts on any of the other performances?
Henry Jones, I just got a few. He was the one I was talking about earlier in particular when he walked in. I felt like he didn't, but I felt like he knew something. Like, I actually liked the way he portrayed the role, because there was a little bit of a creep factor to what he was doing when he walked in. Subtle, not like over the top, because you don't want it to be. But, and I might be alone in thinking this, but I just, when he walked in, I'm like, is he in on this or what's going on? And that was more me as a viewer not remembering what his role was in this. When he walked in, he was introduced and all that. Like, is this another layer that I'm forgetting about? And I really quite liked his portrayal for that purpose. I agree with you that it isn't like this depth-filled role or anything like that, but I did like how he played it when it came in. It kind of worked with the atmosphere and the mood of the story that was being told.
It's so good you mentioned that, Sean, because that he obviously played that role perfectly, because you picked up on what Christopher Reeve's character himself mentions just a short while later, when after Michael Keaton's broken into his desk to look at the script, and Christopher Reeve, later in the movie when he's confessing and everything, he says, thank goodness your attorney came by and noticed I was, trying to obviously hide the script every time so you would want to sneak and find it. And you hadn't picked up on it in days, and he came in and twigged it in 5 minutes. So, that's very, you picked up on exactly that he does, his small part is so important because he notices something Michael Caine hasn't noticed throughout the movie.
Yeah, agreed. Definitely. excuse me. What did you think of the score? It was a lot of harps, a lot of harpsichord.
I enjoyed it, and it made me honestly think of the theme music for Masterpiece Theater. Sort of a little bit classical, and the opening, a little intro about the mystery of the week or whatever is what it made me think of.
And again, the simplisticness of it. It's like, not simplistic, but the limited number of instruments made me think again of a play.
Yeah. That's what I was just going to say, that the way it was presented, it almost felt like you were listening to live music being played as it was going on, which, again, like you said, it gave the feeling of being watching a play, which is, I'm very confident exactly what Lumet was going for. Now, Lumet, just for what it's worth, was the director of 12 Angry Men in 1957, Dog Day Afternoon in 1975, Network in 1976, The Verdict in 1982, as well as Prince of the City, The Pawnbroker, Failsafe, Serpico, Murder on the Orient Express. What a filmography this guy has, you know, and very, very varied in the types of movies that he did. So,
his version of Murder on the Orient Express is the best, you know, nothing against Kenneth Branagh, but Murder on the Orient Express is perfect.
I greatly preferred it over Kenneth Branagh's. I really wasn't actually too wild about Branagh's version. But Dog Day Afternoon is probably my favorite of his movies. I just think that one is like almost a perfect movie. The Verdict, I believe he got Paul Newman's best performance ever. And Newman did not get an Academy Award for that performance is beyond me. Meanwhile, he gets it for The Color of Money, which I felt was not a very challenging role in my opinion. But again, I'm wandering off the topic. I thought he kept it fairly simple in the direction for this movie to give it that live feel. But then there were moments, like Ruth had mentioned, or that Darren mentioned Ruth's observation of where the camera is kind of spinning around as you're watching it, which is done to effect, because at that point you're supposed to be feeling off balance, that you're not supposed to know what's going on. You're supposed to be confused as to what the real level of truth is that you're getting there. And by keeping the camera moving like that, it's keeping you off balance as a viewer. And I think that was, you know, that's perfect.
I would add, when things are escalating between Michael Caine and Christopher Reeve's characters and they're confrontational, and they had those extreme close-ups and different angles, I think that really helped build up the tension and the emotion. And just that from, you know, the directorial decisions on how they framed those shots was really great.
And someone in those moments, sometimes he would go with the quick cuts too, which I feel the quick cut in modern movie making is overused and loses its effect. But when you pick and choose the right moments to do it, it can add to the emotional escalation of a scene. And I think it did here.
Great point. Yes.
So I think, you know, the direction, in my opinion, was excellent. The music was excellent. The acting was almost routinely excellent. So, you know, this has got a lot going on. And the story is really solid. Now, I've never seen the movie Sleuth from 1972, but in the Wikipedia entry for this movie, it says critics gave the film mostly favorable reviews while noting its plot similarities to Caine's 1972 film Sleuth. Have any of you seen that?
Yeah, it's so funny that you mentioned that, Paul, because when we were watching this, I told Ruth, I said, oh, we really need to rewatch Sleuth, which I haven't seen. I haven't seen it this century, I don't think. And it's funny because I immediately got on streaming to see if I could find it to stream. And interestingly, apparently they remade it recently with Michael Caine now playing the older character in the remake. But I had to go online and find a UK DVD or Blu-ray to order. So I'm looking forward to it coming in so I can rewatch it, because I haven't seen it in 35 years.
I may have to seek that one out myself. Just first of all, I already have an appreciation for Michael Caine, and we have, is it Olivier is in that?
I think it is. Yeah.
Yeah. Playing the older role. So, I mean, how bad can you be in that? You know, somehow when I was going through the actors, I passed over, Irene Wirth as Helga Tendorp. And she does not belong with the other characters in this movie. She's playing at a different speed than they're playing. It's like she's in a different movie somehow. But that works perfectly because you feel like everything is slipping by her and that she doesn't know what's going on and that she's a pretend psychic and that, you know, somehow, you know, it's all just a joke to have her in there at all. You think she's just in there really for comic relief. And then somehow, you know, everything turns on that too. And it turns out she really does have these feelings. And she ends up in an interesting way at the end of the movie. Let's put it that way. So
all I can say is, of course, we all want to own the same hat she owns.
I feel like her performance, much like Diane Cannon when she's screaming, can be a little bit annoying as it's going on. But then when you look at it all in its whole at the end of the movie, you think, you know, she really hit all the notes that she needed to hit to make this a better movie. So, again, I enjoyed her performance in hindsight.
The final
scene added the variety and some layers of stress for the characters, too. Like, wondering, is she really figuring out what's going on and just them not quite being certain of her?
There was a sequence where she snuck into the room that I just thought was really cool. And not remembering what happened, my first thought was it Diane Cannon's character? Like, did she somehow survive this and like she's part of another sting? And I mean, obviously that quickly was dispelled, but I really liked how that played out. I saw an interesting little tidbit about the final scene of the movie. It was shot on the actual set of the Broadway production at the Music Box Theater of Death Trap because it was running at the time the movie was made. I thought that was just really cool. I didn't realize that until we were, you know, kind of doing some research as we were preparing for this one.
That's great that they arranged that and took advantage and made that a solid connection with the play.
Yeah, I'm glad you mentioned that, Sean. I had read that before and had forgotten because, yeah, I think Sidney Lumet even mentions that it's like that theater was closed on Mondays, so they would film on Mondays to film what they needed to there, which is really great that they did that.
Sidney Brule also mentions the fact that he had that hit stage play that was the one that, and apparently the real Death Trap in real life, the combined performances came to 1,793 performances at both theaters, which actually surpassed Sidney Brule's record for his fictitious one in the movie, which I thought was, which is really kind of cool too.
So the only controversy for the movie, and I was going to just let it go, but I just feel like it's just worth mentioning, is, you know, there's a scene where Michael Caine and Christopher Reeve kiss. That was not in the play. And apparently when they showed this movie to preview audiences, it was not well received by the audience. So I'm just going to give some credit for the nerve that it took to leave it in there after you got negative reviews from people on it, you know, that you felt they felt it was important to have it and they left it. And ultimately, I don't feel it's a major moment in the movie and I don't think it's worth really making a big deal about it, but it was controversial. So I figured I'd mention it.
Here's why I agree with you. So going back to the fact that I haven't seen this since the 80s, I didn't remember that happened until I saw it in the rewatch. So, you know, was it that big of a deal? I don't know. I didn't, because that wasn't as common in the 80s, right?
Yeah, no, I think it was bold in the 80s to do it. That's where I'm giving credit for being bold.
I'm agreeing with you, but I'm also agreeing with what you were saying about the fact that it wasn't kind of that big of a deal. I didn't even remember it. And I mean, I did when I saw the scene. I'm like, oh, yeah, that was a thing.
Well, the story is that the two characters are gay. So to have two gay characters kiss each other is not the monumental moment now that it would have been in the 1980s. You know, it's not as shocking. But, you know, I guess back in the 80s, you know, that was not really something you saw. So it was, like I said, it was bold of them to put it in there. And, you know, overall, it serves its purpose. It shows that they have that kind of relationship. And that's all cool. So, like I said,
what's...
Go ahead.
Well, I'm just going to say what's interesting to me is to show what a difference 40 years make, because I can remember when this movie came out and all the controversy surrounding that. It's like places, you know, newspapers and magazines didn't really give away the plot points, but they all gave away that. So you sort of know that going in, which makes the early part of the movie, you know, definitely spoils a couple of things related to the early part of the movie. But I can remember that being such a big controversy and so many people talking about it so much. And I can remember when Ruth and I went to see the movie, the cinema was virtually empty. So, you know, does that show that we just went at a slow screening time, or that it was really keeping people away? But then interestingly, when we saw it last year or the year before at Carolina Theater, when that scene came up, the audience whooped and hollered and applauded. So, you know, a very different perception from the audience now as opposed to then for a scene like this.
Yeah, it shows you how, you know, that this, that, you know, society has progressed as far as that goes. And that's something to, you know, to be proud of in its own way. Anyway, any other points to make on this before we rate it?
I would just add that throughout, with all the twists and turns and excitement and suspense, there's humor. Like, there are various witty lines and things that just made me laugh out loud and chuckle. And, you know, just the dialogue I thought was very well done to infuse it with some humor along the way.
It is packed. Yeah. The dialogue is just packed from beginning to end with witty lines. Yes.
I agree. And I think the witty lines in the movie are almost performance dependent. Like, if the actors don't have the right inflection, the right timing, they're not as amusing as they could be. And I think that the two of them really hit, actually the two of them and Helga, the three of them really hit their moments as far as the amusing lines go. So yes, I agree totally on that. So from a rating point of view, I can't go as far as to say this is like a perfect movie, but it is an extremely entertaining movie. It's very well done. It's put together very well. The performances were solid, and as we discussed them, I think even more highly of them than I had beforehand. So I'm going to give it a high Jaws 2. I think it's rewatchable. I could see where some people might rate this as a Jaws, put it that way. But I'm going to give it a high Jaws 2.
This is also a high Jaws 2 for me. I wanted to rewatch it again this morning, just because I enjoyed it last night. That was after years of not having seen it. I actually told my wife, my wife hasn't seen it yet, and I said, we have to watch this together. I think she would really like it. This is a movie I would easily recommend to anyone who's into movies with twists and turns and surprises, that they definitely want to watch it. And it would be one I would be very protective of spoilers for, because I think the first time you watch this, or when you watch it again years later and you forget where some of this went, that's part of the joy of this film, is trying to figure out who's on whose side and where this is going to go. So, I'm glad we thanks for suggesting this. I'm glad we did this one.
Glad you enjoyed it. I'm going to say I'll give it Jaws. Like, for me, the performances were so well done and layered, and so many plot twists and turns. Like, it just thoroughly engaged me. So I'm going to go with Jaws for this one.
Yeah, I think I would have to give this one Jaws too, because it's just sort of the perfect movie for me, because I love mysteries. I love comedies. I love sort of dry senses of humor. And I think this has a lot of those. I love the twists and turns. And this is one of my favorite movies with Michael Keaton in it. And in all honesty, it's like Superman and Superman 2 are two of my all-time favorite movies. I mean, those will always be my two favorite Christopher Reeve movies. But this is those two movies, and this movie are the trifecta of movies, I think, that he did, in my opinion. So I'll give it Jaws 2. Okay, I'm sorry, Jaws as well.
two quick thoughts is one, just – No apologies, but I'm just going to correct you, Darren, because you said Michael Keaton. It's Michael Caine.
Oh, very different Michael.
And this Michael Caine. Well, although in the Wikipedia page it says that this movie was sold as a set with Night Shift, which starred Michael Keaton and Henry Winkler. So, you know, you still have the connection there. And Ruth, it took me probably, I guess, about 6 years, but I'm finally getting even with you that you have a Jaws movie that I'm rating lower than Jaws to get even with you for March of the Wooden Soldiers.
I remember that. Yes.
Anyway,
we're not all the same, so we've got some variety.
Thank you guys for coming on and doing this with us. It's always a pleasure. I always enjoy it. And I hope our listeners enjoy it every bit as much. And thank you to our listeners for tuning in, and we'll see you next week, or in 2 weeks rather. But I want to take a moment. We were going to do it at the beginning of the show, but we failed to do so. Sean and I wanted to mention that there have been some issues with Apple Music, or what it used to be called?
iTunes.
Podcast. Yes, Apple Podcast, and we hadn't been on Spotify, and we weren't on that. But Sean has worked some magic to create a new feed for us. So if you want to get us on those platforms, what you do is go on, and there will be two Is It Jaws feeds that you can go to. One is outdated and no longer updating, and one is totally up to date. I believe that when you look at it in the search, the older one has the old picture of just me, whereas the newer one has the picture of Sean and I. So that'll tell you which one to subscribe to. But hopefully, you know, a lot of people can do that, and we'll be connecting to you that way. Thank you, everybody, for listening.
No comment. Well, I have a comment. No, absolutely and definitely no. I have a name and a reputation. Somewhat tattered, perhaps, but still good for dinner invitations and summer seminars. And I wish to live out my years as the man who wrote The Murder Game, not as the faggot who knocked off his wife. Why, look, a brick fireplace. I wonder if it is practical to the extent that paper can burn in it.
Stop right where you are, fella. You burn that, and I'll go right out of here and ride it someplace else. Now you give it to me. Give it to me! I shall miss you. You opened up certain doors for me. And for that, I'm grateful. Oh, God. This is going to be even harder than I expected. Goodbye, Clift. Bye, Simmy. Bang, bang. Sorry, the click is so anticlimactic, Sydney, but I needed the bullets from that gun. For this one. Now sit down, dum-dum. Sit down! Right in that chair, thank you.